This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Stories today about bargaining chips and industrial policy and Star Wars. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 12th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are geopolitics and international diplomacy, and then there is this.
I fully understand the one China policy, but I don't know why we have to be bound by a one China policy unless we make a deal with China, having to do with other things.
President-elect Trump, of course, this weekend on Fox News, talking to Chris Wallace, explaining how his China policy might not actually be the one China policy, the agreement by which our relationship with Beijing, home of the second largest economy in the world, it must be noted here for the record, how that relationship has been managed for 40-some-odd years. China is China, it says. Taiwan is not, again, geopolitically. Economics isn't necessarily a zero-sum game, but the president-elect is changing the China equation, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports to get us going.
Diplomacy is the history of carrots and sticks, but you got to use the right stick.
There are some things which cannot really be used as leverage because they are too important to all parties involved.
Brad Setzer is at the Council on Foreign Relations. Here's why this issue is so sensitive. Taiwan thinks it's independent, China thinks it's not, and for China, that's not negotiable.
So therefore, you run a really high risk of triggering a confrontation rather than starting a process that leads to a healthier economic relationship.
China could retaliate against U.S. companies selling into China or U.S. exporters that source components from China. Or China could leave trade and economics aside and retaliate by taking military action against Taiwan.
Are we going to go to war?
Jeffrey Frankel is professor at Harvard University. He questions what President-elect Trump wants out of weakening the One China policy.
I don't think he's thought through very clearly what he's demanding of China on the economics.
Trump is trying to use Taiwan as a bargaining chip to get a better trade relationship with China, but that could have the opposite effect. Menzi Chin is professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin.
In terms of the economics, we're going to actually work against our own interests.
That could undermine the economic prospects of hundreds of U.S. industries. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Another day, another market-moving tweet from the president-elect of these United States. The defense contractor Lockheed Martin and its F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program were the targets this time. Trump called the F-35 program and its costs, quote, out of control, and he promised again to save billions of dollars in military and other spending once he takes office. Shares in Lockheed and other defense contractors promptly fell because, of course, capitalism. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, fixing the problems with the F-35 is not going to be easy.
The F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program, started in the mid-1990s, is the largest defense program in history. Ben Fitzgerald follows technology at the Center for a New American Security.
It's intended to replace a large number of current combat aircraft. And in doing so, they've tried to create sort of a one-size-fits-all combat aircraft that can support the Air Force and the Navy and the Marine Corps.
Oh, and for the Marines, it has to be able to land vertically.
The engine pivots from being behind the aircraft to underneath it, which is an engineering marvel.
If all that sounds like a tall order, it has been. Lawrence Korb is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, now with the Center for American Progress. He says the F-35 has been plagued by cost overruns, partly because it was rushed into production before testing was complete.
We're talking about a $1 trillion program over the life of it. So President-elect Trump is absolutely right.
Korb hopes Trump will slow down production and renegotiate the contract. Jacob Cohn with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment says ordering fewer planes would reduce the total cost.
but it'll increase the unit cost as all the fixed costs get shared over a smaller number of aircraft.
Speaking in Israel today, a Lockheed executive said the company has invested hundreds of millions of dollars to reduce the price of the F-35 and looks forward to any questions the president-elect may have. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Crude oil bumped up a bit more than 2.5% today on news of a deal between OPEC producers and non-cartel members to cut their production. That was in Vienna over the weekend, as we were telling you about Friday. The gains may be a bit speculative, though, because the supply cuts don't take effect for another couple of weeks. And also, not included in the deal is the American oil industry. Marketplace's sustainability reporter Jed Kim has that one.
If the U.S. shale oil industry were a hibernating bear, how much poking would it take to wake it up again? American producers have shut down hundreds of wells since oil prices crashed, but Mukul Sharma, who teaches petroleum and chemical engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, says recent upticks in price have been like tantalizing whiffs of spring.
The uptick in drilling has already begun about a month or maybe 2 months ago.
There are now about 500 active oil rigs. It's a far cry from the peak of 1,600 about 2 years ago. Still, Sharma says it's a steady increase that'll likely swell if prices stay higher. And U.S. shale producers are a nimble bunch. Thousands of wells sit already drilled, ready to be completed. Yes, there'd be lag time, but not much.
So that might be 6 months, it might be 12 months. Doesn't happen overnight, but certainly much more quickly than we're used to with oil production.
Jason Bordoff directs the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Why hasn't OPEC reached out to the U.S. to agree to limits? Bordoff says we don't do that.
The U.S. is playing a role in being somewhat of a swing supplier because U.S. shale can ramp up and down much more quickly, but that's based on individual economic decisions made by thousands of producers, not any sort of agreement that a country can make.
So instead of one hungry bear, the U.S. is thousands of... Never mind, I'm bad at metaphors. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
I am obliged by the Business Journalist Code of Conduct to mention here that there is a Federal Reserve meeting this week. I am obliged by reality to tell you that barring a cataclysm, the Fed is going to raise rates. The meeting is tomorrow and Wednesday with a press conference by Chair Yellen Wednesday afternoon. Once again, the game, by the way, what is Janet Yellen thinking? Five words or less. Hit me on Twitter, at Kai Rizdal. We'll see how you do. Wall Street today was mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One way or another, most of the domestic policy arguments that are being had right now center around four little letters, J-O-B-S. Think about it. Immigration, healthcare, infrastructure, jobs, right? New Hampshire is tied with South Dakota for the lowest unemployment rate in this nation, 2.8%. Most everybody in the Granite State who wants a job has one, which sounds great in theory. But as New Hampshire Public Radio's Todd Bookman reports, theory doesn't help companies fill vacancies now, does it?
The offices of Silvertech, a digital marketing firm in Manchester, are going for that Silicon Valley mystique. There's a huge screen to play old school video games on, skee ball echoing in the hallways, and no shortage of casually dressed, well-compensated web developers walking around. Derek Barca is senior director of technology at Silvertech. While he won't say exactly what he pays his staff, he will say...
The average wage has certainly gone up. Even the starting wage has gone up probably $10,000 in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years.
The company has about 70 employees and lots of contracts in the pipeline. One problem, though, they're constantly scrambling to find new workers.
It hasn't happened yet, but we've come to situations where, you know, we have work coming in. We have, you know, a certain amount of people in the building. And if there's not people in the building to do the work, you know, you have to turn the work away.
There are lots of New Hampshire companies in Silvertech's shoes right now, and not just those that need highly educated, highly skilled workers. Take the Edgewood Center, a nursing home in Portsmouth. It has 20 job openings posted, jobs considered low skill, like food service and cleaning. Patricia Ramsey, the CEO, says she's bumped up entry-level wages to $12-13 an hour. But still...
We run ads. We're lucky to get anybody to respond to those ads.
The math here is simple. There are just more jobs than workers to fill them. So it's a good time to be an employee in New Hampshire. Regional economists say that salaries in the state, after stagnating post-recession, are finally inching up. But the problem is, when employers can't hire, businesses can't expand.
You know, right now, if a company is really growing, chances are they're looking outside of the state for expansion.
This is Val Zanchuk with the firm Graphicast. He's also president of the board for the statewide Chamber of Commerce. He says if you are a big manufacturer looking to, say, build a new plant, New Hampshire is not where you're going to do it. The workers just aren't here.
Some companies are just going to throw in the towel and move someplace else where there are people available.
So how exactly did the state end up with a labor shortage? For starters, many younger people are choosing cities like Boston or New York to live over rural New Hampshire. Another factor is the state has what economists like Russ Tebow call a high labor participation rate. That is, most people who can work already do, meaning there's little slack during boom times.
If you can't get more labor out of the people that are already here and you have a hard time pulling more people in, it really creates a problem.
Tebow, who's with the New England firm Applied Economic Research, says throw in the state's relatively high housing costs and you've got yourself a tricky economic problem.
It's a tough nut to crack.
There are plenty of programs, though, trying to address the labor shortage. Community colleges and businesses are partnering to create apprenticeship programs to speed up skills training. And the state is also busy marketing itself through tourism campaigns. The underlying theme, come for the New England charm, stay for the hot job market. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Todd Bookman for Marketplace.
I, like many of you, perhaps, I'm going to swing by the grocery store on the way home tonight to pick up something for dinner. Unbeknownst to many consumers, though, is that there's a whole thing going on behind the stocking of those shelves. Fees companies pay to get their bag of potato chips at eye level as opposed to down on the bottom rack somewhere. Slotting fees. They're called. Phil Edwards wrote about the pay-to-play economics of grocery shelf space for Vox. Phil, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
All right. I realize I am hearkening back to an economy that doesn't exist anymore, but whatever happened to stores just putting stuff on shelves and me buying it? I mean, where did these fees come from?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story that these slotting fees haven't always been around. They really grew in the 1980s, and that's one of the arguments that defenders of slotting fees use. They say that in the 1980s, the number of products that manufacturers made were growing almost exponentially. And as a result, retailers needed a way to kind of cull through that increased number of products.
And you get it, right? Because shelf space is finite. And if you've got a whole bunch of new, potato chips, you got to figure out how to put something where.
Yeah, definitely. And it seems that these slotting fees increase in accordance with the scarcity of the space. So you're going to be paying more if you're trying to get into the ice cream aisle where they have to actually plug freezers in and they can only build so many. Or it can be a fee that manufacturers pay to continue to keep their product on the shelf.
And it's not like a buck and a half, right? I mean, they're pretty steep.
It's pretty significant. One example of a typical slotting fee might be $30,000 to get your product in 350 freezer doors. But some of the best spots often go to manufacturers that buy up a lot of space. So even if you're willing to pay to get into the store, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to have that primo spot to sell your goods.
I imagine this is kind of an abstract thought, but it changes how we eat, right? Because if my ice cream is at eye level in the freezer section, somebody's more likely to buy my ice cream than you know, the stuff down at the bottom in the back.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And that's one of the arguments that critics of slotting fees have against it. So, for example, the Center for Science and the Public Interest issued a report, and their take-home point was basically that manufacturers of junk food were more likely to be able to afford these slotting fees. And as a result, you were pushed to buy Fritos instead of apples or candy bars instead of bananas. So it definitely affects how you eat, not only in the brands that you have, but possibly in the type of food that you're likely to see.
When you walk into your local grocery store now, do you look at it differently? Because I'm gonna.
Oh, I definitely look at it differently. I mean, I am a candy connoisseur. I want all the different varieties of candy. I want candy innovation in this country. And I think that slotting fees are limiting it in some cases. There's not as much variety in candy as I would love to have.
Phil Edwards is a video producer at Vox. His piece is called The Hidden War Over Grocery Shelf Space. Phil, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Up to that point, nobody had thought of merchandising and licensing. Since then, that's become a far more important element.
The Star Wars franchise for better or worse, but always for profit. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 39 points today, about 0.2%, 19,796. The NASDAQ down 31 points, about 0.5%, 54.12. S&P 500 down 2 points, just about 0.1%, 22.56. So, Lockheed Martin, after the president-elect's tweets, landed down 2.4%, started the day down about 8%, so I guess you could call that not so bad. Northrop Grumman dropped 2.2%. Boeing, the target of an earlier tweet about its contract to build a new Air Force One, lifted 0.4% today. That OPEC agreement to cut production pumped up oil prices and oil companies. ExxonMobil up 2.2% today. ConocoPhillips up 1.2%. Royal Dutch Shell up about 1.5%. Bond prices were unchanged. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note stayed at 2.47%, and you are listening to Marketplace. We may not know what next year is going to bring, but your listener support of Marketplace guarantees we'll all be better informed and better prepared. Make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We are, as we sit here in late 2016, just over 10 years past the very first inklings of trouble in the American housing market, the first poppings of the bubble. And while most of the buying part of American real estate has recovered, the renting part is in some trouble. In many parts of this country, rents are going up faster than wages are, which, when you roll that in with an overall lack of affordable housing stock, means more rental evictions. The national real estate company Redfin decided to do some digging into the new housing crunch. Marketplace's Adam Allington has this first look at their study.
There's no easy way to find out exactly how big the eviction problem is in America. Neela Richardson is chief economist at Redfin and a contributor to Marketplace. She says the only way evictions can be tracked is through the courts, which is what Redfin did, pulling court records from 19 states.
We estimate that last year, 3 million families were kicked out of their homes based on the court system. But the actual number is probably far greater, maybe even double that number.
That's because many evictions never make it all the way to court. People leave on their own, or maybe the landlord pressures them out. But for those that do go to court, renters usually end up meeting a guy like Donald Rubottom.
Sheriff's office. Hey, Lou, 9882.
Yeah.
14 North Elmont. Tenant was present. Evicted.
Bye.
Tenfo.
Rubottom is a sheriff in the Baltimore City Sheriff's Department. On this cold fall day, I'm riding with him in southwest Baltimore.
Sheriff's office.
At this stop, a man in his mid-20s answers the door. In his arms is a small baby. Behind him, another one sits in a playpen.
Hey, man, how you doing? You here by yourself?
Yeah.
How many kids you got? You got somewhere to go?
Why is that?
Because I'm here for an eviction.
Well, I know I got the right to pay instead.
Oh, you got the rent?
Yeah.
Oh, good, man.
Fortunately, this eviction doesn't happen. The tenant, Andre Penn, has the $800 rent and gets to remain in the house. But Penn, a construction laborer, says he isn't sure about next month.
You know, because I've been laid off since February, so, you know, work is hard to find. Including that, just you have a utility bills, gas, electric, water bill, you know, it's just a lot on us as a young family.
The tenants at the next stop aren't as fortunate. Their furniture's already packed on a truck when we arrive. A pit bull sits in a cage on top.
Hello, good morning.
Rubottom is respectful, kind, trying his best to keep a tough situation light. One thing he often does is hand out a printout of city services, including shelters if need be. But it's small comfort for the family being put out of their home.
My job as a deputy sheriff is to make sure that the process is fair. That's it. It ain't to lend a hand or do none of that. So I like to have something that I could give you, even if it don't amount to much, it's something.
Back in his squad car, Rubottom checks off another house on a list of 20 addresses scheduled for eviction that day. I ask him how typical this workload is.
It never really gets light, if you know what I mean. I might evict somebody from one property 1 month, and then 3 months later, I'm evicting them from another property, you know?
Once someone has been evicted, their options often go from bad to worse. Move in with family, find a cheaper neighborhood, or possibly end up homeless. Sometimes they also lose their possessions. Matthew Desmond is a Harvard sociologist and author of the book Evicted.
It takes a good amount of time, right, and money to establish a home, and eviction can just delete that.
Not only does having an eviction on your record make it hard to get a new apartment, Desmond says it can also keep you from getting federal aid. He estimates that as little as 1 in 4 who actually qualify for a housing subsidy actually receive it.
So when we think about the typical poor American today, we should think of them as living in the private rental market, getting no help, and spending at least half of their income on housing costs. That's the reality.
With a lack of affordable housing on the market, Desmond says the poorest among us face the toughest of choices: buy food for the family or pay rent. And unfortunately, the rent always eats first. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Got your tickets yet? For Rogue One, I mean, the new Star Wars film comes out on Friday. A lot of people are excited about it, myself included. Some, though, are not, including Stephen Galloway of The Hollywood Reporter, whose recent article is called Why I Hate Star Wars. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why do you feel this way about what is one of the iconic franchises in cinema history?
You know, there's this great dividing line between, I suppose, the lovers of pop culture.
Yeah.
And the lovers of a different kind of film, the kind of films that we're seeing less and less frequently in Hollywood.
When did this film and this franchise, I guess, go from being just a simple movie to a brand and, almost a living thing, for crying out loud?
Well, it did it very early, because when the movie appeared in 1977, it really transformed Fox's fortunes, the studio that made it.
Yeah.
Up to that point, nobody had thought of merchandising and licensing. Since then, that's become a far more important element for companies like Disney, which very shrewdly bought Lucasfilm as it bought Marvel, because that brings in far more revenue.
You call it a perfect petri dish for clones. What is it about this franchise that made it such a generator of sequels and franchisedom?
Well, one thing is it had characters who were simple and clean and clear and memorable. And that tied in with another great change that began to take place in the late 70s, which is the studios started turning to television commercials for marketing. This simple decision had a gigantic impact on the films that were made, because you needed a movie that could be sold in 30 seconds. And that in turn led to what was called high concept filmmaking.
Right.
An idea so simple that in one sentence you knew you wanted to see it.
Let me just interject here and speak for the many, many, many millions of Star Wars fans who will hear this interview and
Don't tell me you hate me too.
Get off your high horse. Yeah. What's the matter with a little escapism and myth building and just a good old-fashioned, 2.5 hours in a dark theater watching a good film?
There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, unless it precludes other things from being made. If you want to see my favorite film of the year, Moonlight,
what a great film. Ugh.
Under $5 million, there are no sequels. There is no merchandising. There are no theme parks.
Yeah.
I mentioned that in the 70s, one of the great changes was the way films were marketed. The other great change was the ownership of the studios. Corporations don't want Moonlight. They want films that predictably bring in money, so that they can do their predicted profits and losses looking ahead several years. That is anathema to creativity.
Is there a way out, of this, or is this just the way Hollywood is now?
The reality is every great economic change changes the nature of content. Television has now started to do extraordinary, interesting, and original work. So there's not a way back, but there is a way forward into creativity.
Are you going to go see Rogue One when it comes out?
I must. That's part of my job.
Stephen Galloway, his job is executive features editor at The Hollywood Reporter. His piece is called Why I Hate Star Wars. Stephen, thanks very much for coming.
Thank you so much.
Well, I've got you, and since I mentioned it, and since it got a whole mess of Golden Globe nominations this morning, check out my interview with Barry Jenkins. He is the director of Moonlight. It's at marketplace.org. Also, go see the film. It's amazing. Final note on the way out today, which comes with a dash of, hey, you kids, get off my lawn. First of all, there's a new set of emojis out. New entrants include an astronaut and a face that is supposed to be barfing, although I don't really see it in that one. Also, and related, there are apparently companies over in the UK looking for emoji translators, saying it's one of the fastest growing languages in the country, which I kind of get. Seriously, check out that barfing face. Tell me if I'm not right, all right? The Dow up 39 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 31 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points. That is a 10th percent there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.